Hello and welcome to What Did I Learn? An 8-part series of short podcasts considering Chapter 11 from the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by Professor Carl Quigley. My learning was prompted through membership of the Telegram-based CTTM, Cutting Through the Matrix Book Club. The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank, owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world. Carol Quigley. Tragedy and Hope, Chapter 11, Changing Economic Patterns, page 515, France. Quigley opens this section with the following statement. Financial capitalism lasted longer in France than it did in any other major country. As with Holland, the French roots of financial capitalism go back to a period preceding the Industrial Revolution, but grew rapidly in the 18th century and were well established upon the founding of the Bank of France in 1800. Quigley notes that at the time of the founding of the Bank of France, financial power rested within 10 to 15 banks whose founders had come from Switzerland in the second half of the 18th century. Protestants all, said bankers were deeply involved in agitations leading to the French Revolution. Being shrewd financialists, when the violence of the revolution got out of hand, they, the bankers, backed Napoleon as a mechanism for the restoration of order. As a reward, Napoleon in 1800 gave the bankers a monopoly over French financial life by handing control to them of the Bank of France. However, 1811 marked a situation in France in which most of the banks were now in opposition to Napoleon, because they objected to Napoleon's focus on war. France, still within commercial capitalism, found constant war to be injurious to commercial activity. Quigley notes that allegiance was shifted within a cohort of banking from Napoleon to Bourbon, and as such, managed to survive the change in regime. By 1815, a political agility seemed to now have entered the equation. Such political agility ensured that the bankers, who had controlled matters under the First Empire, remained the main figures on a board of regents of the Bank of France until a reform arrived in 1936. The chief board figures were Mirabaud, Mallet, Neuflitz, and Hottinger. Quigley notes that throughout the 19th century, a second group joined within the French banking circles. This new group, largely Jewish, was of non-French origin, but majorly Germanic. So, who were they? Well, some interesting names here. They were Rothschild, Hein, Foyle, that's spelled F-O-I-U-L-D, Foyle, Stern and Worms. I kid you not, the latter name Quigley clearly records as Worms, W-O-R-M-S, see page 516. A majority of these were of Iberian origin, like Perrier and Mires. A turf war soon erupted between the old Protestant bankers and the new Jewish kids on the block. Manifestation of this, however, was largely political. Interesting to note here, per Quigley, of course, is that some Jewish groups gave up their religion and moved over to the Protestant banking group, such as Perrier and Hein. Quigley states that banking rivalry continues throughout the following periods. Number one, the July Monarchy, 1830 to 1848. Number two, the Second Empire, 1852 to 1870. And number three, the Third Republic, 1871 to 1940. While the Protestant group remained conservative in outlook, the Jewish group, on the other hand, supported the July Monarchy and the Third Republic, but rejected the Second Empire. Quigley identifies leadership within the contesting banking groups and notes that the Protestant side leader was Mirabaud, and the Jewish side leader was, surprise, surprise, Rothschild. Incredibly, Quigley discovered that, despite the competition for banking dominance, previously described opposing groups who together dominated French banking, nonetheless, in many instances, cooperated with each other. But wait, more complications filtered into the banking mix post-1838, with the slow emergence of some more new kids on the banking block, namely the Catholics, as represented by the following six: de Monchy, Celeré, Davallier, de Germany, Pilerville, Goyen, and de Lubersac. Pardon me for my butchering of the French words. The new six soon split into two directions. Some joined in alliance with the Rothschilds, and the rest, largely Catholic, instead supported heavy industry and rose in tandem with industrial progress through the Second and Third Empire to become a powerful industrial banking force, and was mainly identifiable as the Comte de Forge, the French Steel Trust. And so, by the period 1871 to 1900, the three great economic influencers in France were A. the alliance of Jews and Catholics, dominated by the Rothschilds; B. an alliance of Catholic industrialists and Catholic bankers, dominated by Schneider; and C. a group of Protestant bankers dominated by Mirabaud. Group A accepted the Third Republic, while the other two did not. Group A was the wealthiest in the period 1871 to 1900 by virtue of its control over Banque de Paris et des Pays-Bas, Paribas for short. As a result, by 1906, Paribas held a dominant position in both French economic and political life. However, in 1904, the Protestant bankers established Union Parisienne, an investment bank of their own. Between 1904 and 1919, the Union Parisienne Group and the Comte de Forge Group formed an alliance based upon a common opposition to the Third Republic, and indeed also in opposition to the Paribas Bloc, or, for ease of identification, the Union Comte Bloc. The years 1844 to 1940 were dominated in France by rivalry between the aforementioned two great blocs. And, as one might imagine, such rivalry paralyzed the French political system. The move in France from financial to monopoly capitalism was, in effect, delayed by the struggle between the two great blocs and the paralysis in the political system, as exemplified by the Dreyfus case, that is, a French army captain apparently falsely convicted of passing military secrets to the Germans. And again, in 1934 to 1938, by depression-related political riots. Quigley contends that the financial and political turmoil in France contributed, in no small measure, to the defeat of the French in 1940. Monopoly capitalism in France, Quigley observes, did not become evident until around 1925, and during the long transitional period into monopoly capitalism in France, private bankers continued to exist, and indeed, to grow in power. Governmental obligations, both at home and abroad, held the interest of the French bankers to the extent that both Rothschilds and Malleys developed intimate connections with government, and conversely weak connections with the general economic life of France. In more ways than one, railroads made a difference within the greater French economy. Railroads required capital, way beyond the ability of any private banker to supply. Therefore, investment banks, savings banks, deposit banks, and insurance companies were all tapped as a combined source of railway investment funds. Quigley notes the changing role of the private banker and states that they had become managers of other people's funds rather than lenders of their own, and also had become both more influential and much less noticeable. Billions of francs were now under their control, rather than simply millions. Such control was executed unobtrusively, and not in the bankers' own names. And while acting in the background, they were concealed by the many credit and financial institutions, the latter having been established to tap into private savings. The railroad heralded new economic powers, as iron manufacture and coal mining were on the rise, and all free from banking control, as was the armaments industry. However, the latter was susceptible to government favour or disfavour. Quigley identifies the fields of textiles and iron making as the areas in which, just before 1813, industrial capitalism, albeit slowly, began in France. Capital was not lacking, as apparently the French were careful savers, although with a preference for fixed interest obligations, typically in the form of government bonds, instead of equity capital, and had a marked preference for investing in family businesses rather than in securities of other origin. Quigley notes that corporatization, although permitted under French law since 1807, nonetheless grew slowly, the French preferring the concepts of private proprietorship and partnership, a preference which held strong even into the 20th century. Financing for the aforementioned typically took the form of profits and or family savings. Interesting to note, when the private proprietorships and or partnerships grew in size, the French owners typically cut off the growth of the existing enterprises and instead started one or more new enterprises, which were then run alongside the existing older ones. Strong family feelings usually hampered the growth of large units or publicly owned corporations. Also, there was a reluctance to give outsiders any influence in family business. A restrainer in the growth of corporations was the French preference for fixed interest obligations over equity securities, a dislike by the French of the taxman. Now there's a thing. And indeed, strong feeling against public authority also made it difficult to embark upon public rather than private forms of business. Despite the aforementioned, Quigley notes, industry did grow, with its greatest boost coming along with the railroads, with its need for steel and coal, and indeed, from the government of Napoleon III, 1852 to 1870, which added an additional demand for armaments into the industrial market. In Napoleon's consideration, there was one favoured firm of iron and armaments manufacturers, that is, the firm of Schneider and Le Creusot. As a result, Eugene Schneider became a monopolist in the supply of arms and also sold materials into government-encouraged railway construction. Such involvement with Napoleon ultimately saw Schneider become president of the Chamber of Deputies and, indeed, Minister of Agriculture and Commerce. Quigley notes that post-1871, the heavy industrialists began to experience less political influence, resulting in a decision by them to form an alliance with the Catholic bankers. Two economic blocs now clashed in France, that is, the financial capitalists and the monopoly capitalists. Both had interests in industry and banking, but neither wished for the unorthodox banking procedures, which typically were the goals of monopoly capitalism. Ultimately, monopoly capitalism arrived late to France, and when it did, it arose between the two great blocs, with difficult implications for both, but outside the central control of either. Quigley notes that the name given to the emergent, autonomous, and amorphous power group representative of monopoly capitalism was the Liel-Lyon axis, which rose slowly after 1942, but ultimately took over control of France by 1940. The door to financial capitalism in France was opened by the need for capital for railroad building and the establishment of Crédit Mobilier in 1852, maybe taken as the date of such commencement. Interesting to note, the Crédit Mobilier became the model which credit banks later established in Germany. Crédit Mobilier failed in 1867, but other credit banks were founded in its aftermath. Some were mixed business banks, while others were more specialized, the latter being along the lines of many British and American banks. Quigley contends that excesses seem to be the order of the day for financial capitalism, which he claims was the case also in locations other than France. France, though, Quigley states, was a special case with respect to excess, as excess certainly did exist there, especially post the reforms of 1884. However, French excesses were little when compared to the excesses in both frenzy and fraud as displayed, for example, in the United States. In France and in Britain, financial capitalism exploits were to be found in both foreign fields and in government rather than in business securities. Quigley states that delirium was the order of the day in financial capitalism in the early 1850s and again in the 1880s, and yet again throughout much of the 20th century. Between July 1854 and July 1855, no less than 457 new companies with a combined capital of 1 billion francs were founded in France. However, losses to securities buyers became so great that on March 9, 1856, the government temporarily prohibited further issues of securities in Paris. Quigley notes that once again, in the period 1876 to 1882, over 1 billion francs of new stocks were issued, which led to a crash in 1882. However, financial capitalism had established a firm control in France throughout the entire period 1900 to 1936. A French newspaper article in 1929 estimated that in the period of 30 years from the Humbert embezzlement of 1899, more than 300 million francs, equivalent to the total public-private debt of France, had been taken from the French people by worthless securities. The beating heart of the French economic system of the 20th century rested within a group of near unknown institutions, that is, the private banks, 100 in all, but with only 20 of significance, with two, Rothschilds and Mirabaud, being more powerful than all of the rest. Quigley notes the said institutions were known as the Haute Banque and acted as the high command within the French economic system. Just 40 families closely held their stock, with no reports ever being issued with respect to their financial activities. Quigley further notes that these private banks, with few exceptions, were the ones which set up the Bank of France. Their number breaks down as follows. 1. The seven Jewish banks, namely Rothschild, Stern, Kahn, Danvers, Proper, Lazard, Switzer and Worms. Number 2. The group of Protestant banks as follows. Mallet, Mirabaud, Hein, Neuflitz, Hottinger, Odier and Verne. And number 3. The group of Catholic banks known as Duvalier, Lubersac, Lehindeau, that's spelled L-E-H-I-D-E-A-U, Gauchos, and Dimanche. By the 20th century, fissures and disagreements arose within the various banking circles, but nonetheless, they all cooperated in the management of the Bank of France. Quigley observes that the Bank of France had no autonomous power of its own, being controlled itself entirely by the private banks, and an alignment by some of the latter in the 20th century with a small but amorphous group of industrialists. The Bank of France, therefore, was controlled by 40 families, and with only 200 stockholders being allowed to vote for the members of the Board of Regents, the governing board, kept matters pretty tight. Of the 200 who could vote for the 12 elected regents, 78 were corporations and foundations, and 122 were individuals. Both cases were dominated by the private banks, and had been for so long that regent seats had become practically hereditary. Quigley notes that chief changes in names of regents resulted from the growth of heavy industry and a transfer of seats through female lines. Incredibly, three seats, that is 25% of the seats, were held by the same family for well over 100 years. Notable is the fact that in the 20th century, the names of Rothschild, Mallet, Mirabaud, Neuflitz, Duvalier, Verne, Hottinger, and their relatives were consistently on the board of regents. Quigley contends that the Bank of France filled the role of general staff for the 40 families which controlled the 19 chief private banks. The state was influenced by the Treasury's need for funds from the Bank of France, the influences on other banks being more exclusively French, for example, marriage alliances, indirect bribes, that is, sinecure positions in the banking industry and the like, and by a 100% dependence by French banks on the Bank of France during any crisis brought about by French banks having set aside dependence on gold reserves in favour of commercial paper. Quigley notes that at the time of crisis, the other banks invariably looked to the Bank of France, which had the capacity to involve itself in unlimited notes issuing to get them out of difficulty. Then there were the massive investment banks, or the Banque de Fers, as they were known. They were dominated by Banque de Paris et des Pays-Bas, set up by Rothschild in 1872, and the Banque de Union Parisienne, founded by the rival bloc in 1904. These were suppliers of long-term capital to the industry, taking stock and directorships in return. In 1931, Paribas held securities of 357 corporations, and its own directors and top managers held 180 directorships in 120 of the more important corporations. Quigley notes that control was easily exercised via use of non-voting stock, multiple voting stock, cooperative directorships, and other refinements of financial capitalism. In the period before 1934, among the 16 directors of Union Parisienne were to be found Mirabaud, Hottinger, Neuflitz, Verne, Wendel, Lubersac, and Schneider, the two largest stockholders in the period 1935 to 1937 were Lubersac and Mallet. In 1933, the directors of Union Parisienne held 124 other directorships in 90 important corporations. At the same time, Union Parisienne held stock in 338 corporations. Value of stock held by Union Parisienne in 1932 was 482.1 million francs, and stock held by Paribas was 548.8 million francs. Totaling to a combined stockholding value of 1,030.9 million francs. Quigley identifies the fourth line of control as comprising five chief commercial banks, who together in 1932 had 4,416 branches. At the beginning of the century, the five chief commercial banks had all been within the Paribas consortium, but following the arrival of Union Parisienne in 1904, they slowly moved towards the new bloc, with the Comptoir National des Comptes being the first to make the move over. The control of the two great blocs over the credit banks varied throughout the 20th century. However, During this period, the older Jewish private group steadily lost ground. Bond losses on foot of World War I was the basis of decline in the Jewish group, a situation which had been bound up with international financial capitalism. Regional deposit banks came under the control of one or other of the two blocs. For example, Paribas control was stronger in the north, the west, and the south, while Union Comblock was stronger in the northeast and in the southwest. Likewise, control of savings banks and insurance companies was also shared. For example, the largest insurance company in France, whose capital and reserves amounted to 2,463 million francs in 1931, had as directors Mallet, Rothschild, Neufritz, and Hottinger. Quigley notes that the cooperation between the two blocs relative to lower bank controls did not extend into industrial or commercial activities. Banking competition in the industrial and commercial sectors was severe, with a life or death struggle being the order of the day between 1932 and 1940. Geographically, in France, the banks were divided in influence between the East and the West. The Jewish group, focusing on shipbuilding, transatlantic communications, transportation, and public utilities in the West, while the Protestant Catholic group focused on iron, steel, and armaments in the East. Quigley notes that outside of France, the Jewish group dominated in the colonies, North Africa, and the Eastern Mediterranean, while the Protestant Catholic group focused on Central and Eastern Europe via the Union Européenne Industrielle et Financière, which had been created in 1920 as the economic counterpart of the Little Entente. The latter being an alliance formed in 1920 and 21 by Czechoslovakia, Romania, and the Kingdom of the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes for the purpose of common defence against any Hungarian revisionism. French banking international reach. Yes, the Jewish bankers were into petroleum products via the Banque de Paris des Pays-Bas, which in turn controlled Compagnie Française des Pétroles, which was allied to Standard Oil and to Rockefeller. The Catholic Protestant bankers, on the other hand, via Union Parisienne, controlled Petrofina, which was allied to Royal Dutch Shell and to Detering. Quigley gets into some name-dropping here. Jules X. Bryant, partner of Lubersac AC, in which François de Wendel was the majority owner, was also director of Union Parisienne and of Petrofina. And Alexandre Ungener, partner of Lubersac AC, was also a director of Union Parisienne and of Petrofina. Charles Sargent, once Under-Secretary of the Ministry of Finance and Sub-Governor of the Bank of France, was for years chairman of Union Parisienne and played a role in one bloc similar to that played by the Horace family in another bloc. Quigley goes on at this point to widen the field of names of individuals, many of whom moved through a revolving door, so to speak, between the banking industry and government. It is evident, therefore, that relationships between political individuals within the elevated administrative class in France and both industry, government, and banking could usefully be visualized as a complicated wiring diagram. Outside of banking, the French economy was organized through a series of trade associations, industrial monopolies, and cartels, typically controlled by the Protestant, Catholic, private banking bloc. While the Jewish banking group, however, mostly held to old-style financial capitalism nonetheless, some individual companies controlled by the Jewish group joined the cartels and associations set up by the rival bloc. Infiltrations? Possibly. Quigley notes that central to the system of monopolistic industrial control within France was an entity known as Confédération Générale du Patron Français, CGDPF, which, post the 1936 Matignon agreements, did the collective bargaining for most French industry. Financial controls, family alliances, and interlocking positions saw a complicated web of associations, cartels, etc., interlocking into the CGDPF. Within the system, the Comte de Forges Trade Association, representing a widely scattered collection of small iron enterprises, held pivotal position. Quigley highlights the fact that the Le Creusot factories of the Schneider family, having been so favoured by Napoleon III in 1838, ultimately emerged as the chief metal company in France. Circa 1870, virtually the entire metal industry of France began to turn towards monopoly capitalism, and as such, to seek capital from private banks. Quigley notes that the French favoured a concept which they identified as comptoir, that is, a joint selling agency. For example, in 1884, the Comte de Forges was formed as an association of metallurgical industries by use of a single comptoir, so as to prevent price competition. 100 billion francs in securities was reflective of the over 200 companies which, together with the 8 billion francs of capitalization, were within the Comte de Forges in 1939. By 1939, 75% of French steel production was from just six companies. It was similar within the French coal industry. Quigley finds the aforementioned unsurprising, as the coal industry was largely dominated by the same group as the steel industry. By 1938, 77% of French coal production came from 14 companies, three of which were owned by Wendel. Ergo, Wendel controlled 15.3% of French coal production directly, and indeed more indirectly. Quigley notes the existence of Comte Central de Houlier, which, similar to Comte de Forges in steel, played the same type of role in the coal industry. The latter was supported by taxes on collieries, which were based upon output. French coal was sourced in two areas as follows: the northwest around Lille and the southeast around Lyon, with the latter being controlled completely by the Union Comte Bloc. However, the northwest area was more heavily influenced by Paribas. Quigley notes that the significant influence of the Union Comte Bloc in such important areas as iron, steel and coal was balanced to an extent by the skillful use of communications by Paribas in their takeover efforts relative to strategic points in communications and in publicity. He records that there were only 1,506 corporations registered on the Paris Stock Exchange in 1936, of which apparently only 600 were important. If we added the 150 to 200 important corporations not Paris registered, then we would arrive at a total of 800 firms. Of the 800 firms, Paribas controlled 400 and Union Comte controlled 300. The whole Paribas system in the 20th century was controlled by, guess who? Baron Edward de Rothschild. However, the active head was René Mayer, who was manager of the Rothschild Bank and a nephew by marriage of James Rothschild. Centre of operations for the Paribas system was Banque de Paris et des Pays-Bas, which in turn was managed until 1937 by Horace Finlay, of a Hungarian Jewish family which had been brought to France by Rothschild in 1880. Banque de Paris ruled the significant part of the French economy controlled by this bloc. For example, many foreign and colonial enterprises, the likes of utilities, ocean shipping, airlines, shipbuilding, and critically, communications. Quigley now focuses upon Havas, a French monopolistic news and advertising agency. Havas could and did either suppress or spread both news and advertising. Havas received secret subsidies from the French government for almost 100 years a fact first revealed by Balzac, a French novelist and journalist. Subsidies which, by the late 1930s, had reached fantastic size. Haché, another significant French publisher, had a monopoly in the distribution of periodicals, and sizably so in the distribution of books. Interestingly, this particular monopoly could be used to kill newspapers, which came to be regarded by the controlling powers as objectionable. L'Ami de Peuple, owned and operated by François Coetzee, became the recipient in 1930 of exactly such treatment. Post-1934 and 1937, both major blocs, Union Compte and Paribas, suffered badly, the former as a result of world depression and the latter by a rise in anti-Semitism. Controversy about orthodox and unorthodox financial methods of dealing with the depression, and particularly by a growing foreign crisis. Rothschild desired an alliance with Russia and adopted a policy of resistance to Hitler, while supporting loyalist Spain. Rothschild also favoured a continuation of orthodox financial policies and the building up of labour unions against Comte de Forge. However, the Rothschild approach, Quigley asserts, collapsed from its own contradictions, a general lack of faith in it, and indeed pressure from Great Britain. In an almost dialectical nature, as the two older banking blocs weakened, a new kid arrived on the block. It was known as the Liel-Lyon axis. The LL axis comprised of two regional groups, namely Northern Liel and Southeastern Lyon. Liel had a branch running to Brussels, while the latter had a branch running to Basel in Switzerland. Quigley notes that by virtue of monopolistic and interrelated economic activity in the following areas: electrical utilities, chemicals, artificial textiles, and light metals, and the associated banks involved, the cooperative axis, which came to be identified as the Liel-Lyon axis, had emerged. Interrelationships within the Liel-Lyon axis existed for a variety of reasons, namely monopolism, narrowly controlled natural resources, large-scale operation, utilizing byproducts and affiliated activities for profitable operation, and use of closely held patents. The interrelationships, Quigley states, were rooted in the following reasons. The northern utilities were based on coal and the southeastern on water power. Manufacture of light metals such as aluminium were concentrated where water power was available, and manufacturing was conducted by electrolysis, which in turn produced chemical byproducts. Therefore, the two light metal firms in France moved also into chemicals manufacture. Quigley notes that the textile industry was already centred in the north and in the southeast. When this industry turned to the manufacture of artificial fibres, it needed to ally itself with chemical firms, something which was achieved through the associated Gillet family. The textile families, for example, the Mott family, already controlled, in cooperation with Paribas, the richest of the coal mines. The coal mines began to generate electrical power at the mine sites, following which all byproducts were utilized for chemical and for textile manufacturing. The textile families of the north, for example the Mott family, were already related to the textile families of the south, for example the Gillet family, both by marriage and by trade association. Therefore, it was easy for the Liel-Lyon axis to grow, and such occurred along family interrelationship lines. Quigley states that as a result of stalemate between the two great blocs, France became completely paralysed and as a result suffered defeat in 1940. Strangely, apparently defeat was acceptable to the Liel-Lyon axis because, with German assistance, the LL axis began to take over the whole economy of France. Quigley now looks at foxes let loose in the henhouse. The Paribas bloc was destroyed, by the anti-Semitic laws, and many of its chief strong points were taken over. The Union Kampfblock was crippled by, for example, the forced sale of Schneider's foreign holdings and most of Wendel's domestic holdings to the Germans, main German beneficiary being Hermann Göring Werk, and the seizure of other Lorraine iron properties, and the complete abolition of the Comte de Forge itself. Meanwhile, the LL axis strengthened. The French chemical industry was forced into a single corporation, that is, Société Francolor, controlled by the LL axis and by IG Farben. The light metals industry was centralized within LAS Forge et Camaro, and the textile industry was centralized under France Rayon and ended up under joint Gilet German control. The automotive industry was controlled under the Comte d'Organisation d'Automobile and set up as joint manufacturing under Société Générale Française de Construction d'Automobile. The entire system was controlled by a small group in Lyon, centered on the Gilet family, and represented politically by Pierre Laval. Quigley notes, with the three great economic blocs in France cooperating with respect to pricing policy, it became very difficult for Americans to understand what was going on, because no price competition could be observed within the market, as should typically have been the case. Cooperations also existed, by the way, in attitudes towards labour, although to a lesser extent. Where rivalries emerged were within the areas of economic and political power, and manifested in the form of struggles for control of sources of raw materials, supplies of credit and capital, and in the instruments of government. Quigley notes that in Europe, competing economic groups saw nothing wrong in cooperating in the use of the power of the state to enforce joint policies in the areas of prices and labour. Defeat for the French in 1940 finally shattered the stalemate between the great power blocs, which had paralysed France in the 1930s and done so much to make defeat possible. The two older blocs were disrupted under both German occupation and the Vichy regime, Paribas by the anti-Semitic laws, and Union Kampf because its holdings were desirable to the Germans and to the French collaborators. The LL axis, led by Banque de Indochine and Banque Worms, sought to take over most of the French economy as willing collaborators, and with Vichy politician Pierre Laval. While they were reasonably successful in doing so, the economic confusion of the occupation and the burden of the German occupation costs made it impossible to gain much benefit from their newfound position. Quigley observes that the three pre-war blocs played no significant role in France post-1945. However, René Mayr, active head of the Rothschild family interests, did become Minister for Finance in the early post-war government. In 1962, de Gaulle made the director of the Rothschild Bank Georges Pompidou Prime Minister. Implementation of new economic procedures in France post-World War II were hampered by a political paralysis within the French parliamentary system, which was mainly due to a multiplicity of political parties. France was stalled in attempts to establish a satisfactory economic system by a military crisis in Indochina and a protracted and frustrating civil war in Algeria. The aforementioned difficulties did not begin to diffuse until around 1958. Quigley credits France, however, with the achievement of having established the European Common Market, which Quigley goes on to describe as having been decisive. The European Common Market, Quigley notes, was established by the Treaty of Rome in 1957, with the following six members: France, West Germany, Belgium, Holland, Italy, and Luxembourg. The plan for the European Common Market was the removal of internal customs barriers among members and the adoption of common external tariffs against outsiders, with the objective of the creation of a mass market to facilitate lower costs in mass production. Quigley notes that political instability in France was relieved by the establishment of a more authoritarian Fifth Republic, that is, via its constitution of the 4th of October 1958, following which France was then in a position to contribute more meaningfully to the development of the European common market. Fiscal austerity came to France in December 1958 with the devaluation of the franc, followed almost immediately by a rise in economic activity with growth in industrial production of 6.3% by 1961 and almost 8.5% in 1962. French gold reserves doubled within 2 years of the franc devaluation. Quigley notes that an OECD report of 1962, that is, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and a successor organization to the Marshall Plan, recorded that the French situation was an economic miracle. However, farmers and government employees seemed to have obtained less than their fair share of said economic miracle, and indeed the ugly spectre of inflation in living costs began to emerge. Quigley notes that the new economic activity brought France and the other European common market countries up to an unprecedented level of prosperity, surging ahead of the drab conditions reflected in what he describes as the unfortunate countries behind the Iron Curtain. The British had formed a European Free Trade Association of the Outer Seven, that is, Austria, Denmark, Norway, Portugal, Sweden, and Switzerland, for the purpose of free trade among members, but no tariff against others. The British further sought to lift their economy with an attempt to join the European Common Market in 1962, but were stalled in their aspirations by de Gaulle, who required Britain to first renounce its so-called special relationship with the United States. And there's more, much more. Why not check out the Alan Watt CCTM channel on YouTube, where Melissa regularly presents Redux material from the late great Alan Watt, and in addition presents her own ever-interesting real history programs. In addition, also on YouTube, you have the very excellent Hayes Reviews channel, where you can enjoy full online readings and genial host interactions relative to a huge range of truly significant books. Books which reveal truth relative to history from the very pens of movers and shakers of bygone eras. They may be gone, but to this day, we are living a dark legacy of their anti-human plans and schemes, which are being actualized by their intergenerational ideological devotees and collaborators. I hope you have found the information which was presented here to have been both interesting and indeed educational. Thank you for your time and attention, and please do check out the other 7 podcasts in this mini-series.